Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The NASDAQ up and running today? Check. Steve Ballmer leaving Microsoft? Check. Ben Affleck as Batman? Check. Wait, what? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 23rd of August. Glad you could be with us. I totally get that I shouldn't have to do this, but I am pleased to be able to report nonetheless that the NASDAQ was glitch-free as we head into the weekend. Price quotes were where they were supposed to be, no three-hour siestas where they weren't supposed to be. But as regulators and the people who run the NASDAQ try to figure out what exactly happened, I'm going to go way out on a limb here and ask what I know y'all are thinking. They didn't have a plan B? Here's Marketplace's Sabri Benishour.
Michael Goldstein chairs the finance department at Babson College, and he has a question that a lot of people are asking right now.
Why didn't NASDAQ have a backup?
Well, in many cases it does. There are 13 stock exchanges in the U.S. If one goes down, investors can go through the others, but only if they know the stock prices. And what failed yesterday is the system that tells everyone the NASDAQ stock prices.
It's kind of ridiculous. It's a Rube Goldberg machine. Here we call it a fragmented maze of destinations.
Joe Saluzzi is with Themis Trading. He says the complexity of the system makes it vulnerable. And he says there wasn't a backup.
As far as we know, that does not exist.
NASDAQ CEO said today he agrees that U.S. markets should have a system that backs up stock quotes for all exchanges. Eric Hunsader with data company Nanex says exchanges haven't had the incentive to focus on backup systems for price sharing programs because the biggest traders, they don't need them. They're so big, they have their own.
Exchanges cater to the high-frequency traders.
High-frequency traders, those are the big guys, are their most lucrative clients. NASDAQ did not respond to requests for comment. Charles Jones teaches finance at Columbia. He says the question remains, why was there a single point of failure?
This is a choke point. So you would think that the choke point should have all the redundancy in the world.
But he says no matter how much stock exchanges invest,
I don't think we'll ever get to 100% reliability.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Our fragile markets seem as good a place as any to start our regular weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond on a Friday. Very Wall Street, at least to begin with, this week. Heidi Moore from The Guardian and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville are at Marketplace East, otherwise known as our New York City Bureau. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Heidi, you and I talked about this yesterday, so I will give you first whack at this question. It's a basic one, and here you go. What kind of way is this to run a railroad with the NASDAQ? Come on.
This is no way to run a railroad. However, there are people who are defending NASDAQ, saying that at least they fixed the problem. I mean, it's running well today. So they may not have communicated well about it, but they did get it fixed.
That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Cardiff, come on. At least it didn't break today. That's bananas.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is another instance where we see that the way we trade securities now has just become immensely complicated, and how in the last 10 to 15 years – new and better technology, along with all these participants finding ways to get around new regulations, have found a way to make things really complicated to make a little more money. So it's true. The immediate effect of what happened yesterday was something akin to everybody taking a long lunch, right? And
yeah.
Then catching up on their work later.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay. But
yeah.
I mean, but it is troublesome that these kinds of things just seem to keep happening. And there's got to be a way to make these systems more robust.
Well, Heidi, what about that? My money is things get worse, not better.
Well, that's generally true just because of the level of complexity. I mean, it's going to happen again. Bob Greifeld, who's the CEO of NASDAQ, gave an interview, and he considered himself happy if they could get above 99% reliability in doing these. I mean, imagine that. He's just conceding. You cannot get 100%, and he's right.
Okay, but let's do the counterfactual here, Cardiff, and then we'll move on.
Sure.
The global economy did not implode. Nobody was, you know, jumping out of windows on Wall Street. I mean, it was a problem. They fixed it, and we all moved on.
That's true. It wasn't that big of a problem this time, but you know, that's sort of like saying, well, you know, just because it didn't sink the ship, you know, in this storm, that's no reason not to patch things up. I mean, you really do want these systems to be a little bit less fragile, and at the very least, as I think your reporter brought up in that segment, you want there to be a plan B. You want there to be a backup plan, and you want these companies to be more transparent about what's happening, not just to their biggest clients, but to everybody, to the public at large.
Yeah. Key point, the NASDAQ OMX is a company, and it's got shareholders, and it's, in theory, a viable business. All right, we will move on. We will go now to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, Heidi, where central bankers from pretty much the entire country and parts of the world are gathered. Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, said today, listen, it is too soon for central banks to withdraw their unusual support. She's talking, obviously, about quantitative easing here in the States. What do we think central bankers will do? Will they listen to Ms. Lagarde, or will they sort of start pulling the plugs?
Well, they want to start pulling the plugs, but that's going to be difficult because what we've seen is that the markets freak out every time Ben Bernanke even whispers about tapering, which is reducing the level of stimulus. So, you know, maybe they may want to, but really, you know, this whole crisis has made the central bankers into heroes. I don't blame them for wanting to extend it a little bit more.
Cardiff, thoughts on a 3-day weekend in Jackson Hole?
Yeah, I mean, there's a real underlying tension here, and Heidi's absolutely right. The problem is that central banks have really been the only game in town the last few years because governments have really fallen down on the job. They haven't been helping out. They haven't been providing the right kind of stimulus. And so what's happened is that central banks have been undertaking all of these what's called unconventional policy. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that these policies do cause distortions and they do cause sort of unintended consequences. And yet they have to keep doing it because if they were to stop doing it, then there would be absolutely no support. So it's unfortunate, but I think they have to keep going.
You know, so Heidi, the Fed minutes came out earlier this week, the Fed minutes from the July meeting, and there was much tea leaf reading and this and that. The markets got a little squidgy, but basically the Fed says, listen, we're going to figure it out when we figure it out. Bear with us. Are the markets ready to hear that answer?
Well, it's a much better answer than they got before because, as I said, you know, if they think their welfare is ending, they start freaking out about where to get more. But, you know, I think the Fed has managed its communication policy by being maybe too open. It's giving the market more information than the market can understand. Yeah. The market can't think 2 years ahead like the Fed can. So when you say we're going to taper in 2 months or 2 years or whatever, the market can't process that. They have the memory of goldfish.
Wow. All right. We got to go. That's what an image to leave on. Heidi Moore from The Guardian, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FD Alphabet. We're out of here. See you guys.
See you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, speaking of the markets, the happy music. To wrap things up, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know that saying about not believing everything you hear? You add the internet into that, and you'd best start questioning pretty much everything. Here's one we heard this week, that your smartphone is as big an electricity hog as a couple of refrigerators. We asked Marketplace's Adrienne Hill to check that out, and while she was at it, figure out why tidbits like that get passed around, true or not.
Could it possibly be true that watching videos on my smartphone, which I sometimes do, uses as much energy as two refrigerators that cool and hum day and night?
This is an example of a claim that sounds interesting, but really has no basis in fact.
Jonathan Kumi is a research fellow at the Steyer Taylor Center for Energy Policy and Finance at Stanford University. Kumi has devoted years of his professional career to fighting this refrigerator analogy because it came up more than a decade ago by the same author, only then claiming a Palm Pilot uses the same electricity as a fridge. Fighting it again now, says Kumi.
Yeah, I'd say I'm pretty frustrated by it. I'd rather not have to spend time rehashing this stuff.
But the claim is back, so Kumi is back, figuring out just how much electricity goes into making and using my smartphone.
So he said 700 kilowatt hours, I say 60.
The he here is Mark Mills. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and author of The Phone Equals Refrigerator Claim, most recently in a paper called The Cloud Begins with Coal, sponsored by the mining and coal industries. Mills says he wants to get people thinking about how much electricity these devices use.
Do you think that the refrigerator analogy distracts people from your bigger point?
No, the reason we're talking is because it focuses on the bigger point. It's exactly the point of it.
And he says he stands by his calculations.
And then the debate makes it an interesting conversation like we're having. It is accurate. It uses a lot of electricity. Now, if someone were to say it's not equal to a refrigerator, it's equal to half a refrigerator or a tenth of a refrigerator, that's still a big number.
Why use this analogy again? Why compare a phone to a fridge when he got so blasted the first time? Bruce Nordman is a research scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory.
Yeah, so if I came up to you and remarked that there's a one-headed cat around the corner from your house, you would be totally uninterested.
Yep, one-headed cat, seen him before.
But if I said there's a three-headed cat...
Three-headed cat?
You'd be amazed that it exists and want to go see it. And so these fantastical assertions naturally attract people's attention, whether or not they're actually real.
He says the idea that our phones use as much energy as a fridge is a three-headed cat. It's just not real. And still, these things get picked up and passed around, which raises another question. Why? Jonah Berger is a marketing professor at the Wharton School and author of Contagious, Why Things Catch On.
Thinking about a smartphone, a tiny small device that sits in our pocket using the same amount of energy as a huge refrigerator seems so amazing that we just have to share it with someone else. It's a neat little factoid that makes us look sharp, even if it's not in this case actually true.
He says the controversy around it helps make it sticky, and it taps into a broader conversation about the environment.
If everyone's talking about the environment, they're looking for something else to add to that conversation. Well, we all know that gas prices are up. What's there to say that's new? But if I can plug in a new fact to that bigger conversation, it's going to get talked about a lot.
Even if that fact isn't factual. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
The NFL season starts 2 weeks from last night, Baltimore at Denver on the 5th of September. It's going to be a big deal, as befits the $9 billion a year business that the NFL is. But with all that income comes a headache or two. The NFL and one of its broadcast partners, ESPN, are getting some blowback today. ESPN has pulled out of an investigative project with Frontline on PBS about head injuries in the National Football League. The league, we should say, denies pressuring ESPN in any way about that project. John Orand is the media reporter at Sports Business Journal. John, it's good to have you here.
Thank you, Kai.
The NFL is known to be vigilant, shall we say, in protecting its brand.
They're correct. It's called the Shield. They love to protect the Shield. In fact, that's one of the reasons that they started their own network, the NFL Network.
Right.
And what's ironic is that on the NFL Network, they do cover the concussion issue, and they hired a veteran on-air broadcast reporter and Andrea Kramer to cover that issue. So they're not scared of this, and they're not shy of it. So that's what makes this, what happened, so much more confusing.
ESPN pays the NFL $1 billion a year, $1 billion a year to carry their programming. Does it make sense that they would be sensitive, I suppose?
Oh, absolutely. They pay them $1 billion now. They just signed a deal that goes into the next decade that pays them close to $2 billion a year. And it includes highlight rights, and it includes the Monday night football games. This is big business. And we're picking on ESPN, but it's big business for Fox, mm-hmm. and it's big business for CBS, and it's big business for NBC as well. The NFL has talked to all of those networks about some of their programming. What's making this situation so unique to me is that it's so rare that this gets public like this. I think that the last time that I can really think of something like this going public is back in 2003 when ESPN had Playmakers, and everybody refers back to that.
Right.
And it's been about 10 years since then.
Remind folks what that was.
Playmakers was an entertainment show that ESPN had produced that was loosely based on the NFL. It was about a football league, and it involved steroids. It showed players taking drugs. It showed abuse. It just showed the whole underbelly of the NFL, and the NFL hated that, and they pressured ESPN to stop it, and ESPN stopped it.
This does not, just journalistically, it doesn't look great for ESPN.
Journalistically, this is a huge black eye for ESPN, absolutely. I think that it shows that ESPN, bowed to some sort of pressure that was given by the NFL. And I think that's a real shame, because ESPN has spent the past couple of years hiring some of the best sports journalists out there. They have taken people from the New York Times, some of the best newspapers, in order to get in there and cover these types of topics. What I'm going to be looking for is whether those reporters that came over find this untenable, because they're hireable people. And if they start to leave, then we'll know that something's up.
Can ESPN have it both ways, though? Can they be broadcast partners with the NFL and then do solid sports journalism beyond highlights and scores of the day?
That is literally the billion-dollar question. I think they can. I think that there's enough of a division between the business side of ESPN and the editorial side of ESPN. But the problem is that it's all called ESPN. Nobody suggests that 60 Minutes and CBS News kowtows to the NFL. But CBS also pays $1 billion for the rights to carry the NFL games as well. But there's a stark difference between CBS News and CBS Sports. With ESPN, ESPN News is ESPN. ESPN, the business, is ESPN. You hold Bob Lee exactly the same as, the people on First Take who argue about Tim Tebow.
John Orand, he's the media guy at the Sports Business Journal. John, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, you need your receipt with that, miss?
They'll hold the receipt up to, like, a 7-year-old or next to their huge German Shepherd dog, and it is a little ridiculous.
Why are those CVS receipts so doggone long anyway? But first, let's do the numbers. Trading, as I mentioned, went on uninterrupted today. The Dow Industrials advanced 46 points, about a 3%. Closed above 15,000, it did. 15,010, to be precise. NASDAQ picked up 19 points, a 0.5%, 3657. The S&P 500 tiptoed up 6 points, about a 3%, ended things at 1663. The Dow ended the week on a 2-day winning streak, but still down a 0.5% for the 5 days gone by. The tech-heavy NASDAQ gained 1.5% this week. The S&P 500 added about a 0.5%. Oh boy, it's a teenage wasteland out there. American Eagle Outfitters and Abercrombie & Fitch both got punked by investors earlier this week after reporting weak profits. Today, it was Aeropostale's turn. The chain shed 20% after it warned that back-to-school shopping has been slow. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for July. The U.S. Open tennis tournament gets underway in New York. And if you have a dog, you'll need to find an excuse to call in sick. Monday is National Dog Day. You owe it to Fido to play hooky. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Microsoft shares jumped 7-some-odd% today. Not a new product, no new version of Windows coming out. It's more of a personnel kind of thing. The company said this morning CEO Steve Ballmer is going to retire within the next year. Traders rejoiced, I think it's fair to say, and now a selection committee will assemble, Bill Gates and all the other top brass. Their task is to find the person to put the company's recent failures behind it, and then to what exactly? Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
Back when Microsoft was an energetic tech startup, likability wasn't an issue. But today, Microsoft has to compete with companies like Apple and Google, which people love. But as tech analyst Jeff Kagan points out, People don't love Microsoft. They put up with it.
In order for companies to win today, customers have to love them.
Do you feel like you could ever love Microsoft?
Microsoft has been abusing customers for decades. So Microsoft's been with us for so long, they feel like family. They're one of those abusive kind of relatives, though.
So who can take the reins of Microsoft and look deep into our eyes and make us fall in love with it? A charismatic young tech wizard? A debonair silver fox with a heart of gold? Or perhaps a man like Herb? Southwest Airlines CEO Herb Kelleher.
As I have frequently said, you are my heroes. Because of you today, Southwest Airlines is a symbol of freedom.
As Kelleher says in this video, his employees are his heroes. His strategy? Putting employees and customers' needs ahead of investors.
The problem with Microsoft's performance is that they've been focusing on the shareholder, and that's backwards.
The result of Ballmer's strategy has been a series of flops like crummy tablets, confusing operating systems, and the Zune. But according to consultant Seth Harris, even with all the flops, Microsoft still does a lot of things right.
Good leadership looks at the situation, preserves the part of the culture that's working very well.
In other words, a leader that understands more than just software. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
When it comes to personnel matters, we generally confine ourselves to titans of industry and Fed chairmen, the biggies, you know. But on a Friday at the end of August, well, you do what you gotta do. Ben Affleck has been handed the keys to the multi-bajillion dollar Batman franchise. The cape has been passed, if you will. Affleck will be Batman in a double bill with Superman in the next sequel to The Man of Steel. The comic book crowd is none too pleased, but Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports these franchises, much like the superheroes themselves, are virtually indestructible.
How seriously do people take Batman? Rachel Abrams covers the movie biz for Variety.
There has been a lot of backlash online. There are a couple petitions to remove Affleck from the film on change.org.
The news got a better reaction from the people who follow the money in Hollywood. Sharon Waxman is editor of TheWrap.com.
Good for Warner Brothers for getting Ben Affleck to be a superhero, because Ben Affleck had said that he was never going to do it again after he had a horrible experience playing a blind superhero in Daredevil.
I prowl the rooftops and alleyways at night, searching for justice.
You might remember there was no sequel. Did Affleck kill the chances for a Daredevil franchise?
The proof is in the pudding. There hasn't been a Daredevil franchise, so that's probably fair to say.
No word yet on how much Affleck will be paid, but Christian Bale reportedly turned down $50 million to put the cape back on. Many successful superhero movies have relied on virtually unknown actors, but Waxman says star power can help the film stand out.
There's a lot more competition now for superhero movies because all the major studios are doing that as kind of a single diet in the summertime.
Even if the film becomes a monumental flop, anyone remember George Clooney in Batman and Robin? Don't expect it to kill the franchise. In the last 25 years, globally, the Batman movies have brought in almost $4 billion. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Next time you're in a CVS pharmacy, the biggest pharmacy chain in the country for what it's worth, and you're buying, say, a pack of gum, when the clerk asks you if you want your receipt, think twice, because I promise you the thing is going to be as long as your arm. Your item, and then a solid like 2 feet of coupons and promotions and surveys and all the rest of those kinds of things. Katie Manderfield wrote about it for Fast Company. Katie, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What is the deal, man, with CVS receipts? It's bananas.
Well, apparently they are way too long.
Well, so the truth is I was at a CVS last night after we decided we were going to talk to you. And for the first time, I actually noticed how long these things are. It was, I kid you not, 27 inches long. And I bought two things.
No, it is ridiculous. And you have this moment when you're standing at the counter where you're sort of like, is it really this long?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the moment that a lot of consumers have been documenting and capturing and uploading onto Twitter and Facebook.
There are those, though, on both the Twitter feed and in the comments to your piece in Fast Company who say, you know what? If you pay attention to those receipts, man, there's bargains and surveys and you can win things and get discounts and all kinds of stuff.
I mean, I had a receipt once where you could get just $10 back if you bring it back. I think part of it is that people aren't necessarily using the receipts because they are so long. It's sort of an inconvenience, I would say, to put in your purse or carry with you in your pocket.
Why'd you do this piece?
My colleague, Matt Morandi, actually just noticed that this meme was happening and that people were sort of hilariously documenting these really, really long receipts. And then, of course, once we found the requisite parody account, which is CVS_receipts, we knew, you know, it was just bound to become something big. So we sort of wanted to use it as, you know, a case study to see what was happening with this trend and to see, you know, how CVS really could leverage the laughs.
Well, explain that a little bit. I mean, are they getting, yes, they're getting a mention here, but only in the most not flattering way.
Right. And I think that's sort of the thing that's happening nowadays, especially with these sort of memes that happen organically, is that it's not necessarily something CVS would choose of their own volition. But because this is happening, I mean, the good news at the end of the day is that people are talking about CVS. And so how can they sort of leverage this organic, you know, virality to their advantage?
The fake Twitter account on this thing is kind of funny, and people post sort of amusing sort of CVS things. What's your favorite CVS receipt joke?
I really like the one that says, I expected to see it start out with, quote, call me Ishmael.
That's very, very highbrow, very highbrow.
One, too, that said, the favorite part of my CVS receipt is the sports section.
I mean, we're killing a lot of trees with these things.
Yeah, and the pictures are great. I mean, just to see, literally, it's, you know, they'll hold the receipt up to, like, a seven-year-old or next to their huge German Shepherd dog, and it is a little ridiculous.
And thus a meme was born. Katie Manderfield, she's a senior editor at Group SJR. Her piece on CVS receipts was in Fast Company. Katie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which we turn to YouTube to mark the departure of Steve Ballmer from Microsoft. He is known for his intensity, Mr. Ballmer is, his enthusiasm for the corporate cause, and he does like to rally the troops.
Developers, 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 developers. Developers, 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 developers.
Picture it if you can, him all sweaty up on stage doing that. But you know, a CEO's got to do what a CEO's got to do to get his team excited, right?
Web developers! Web developers! Web developers!
Radio hosts and producers and editors and engineers. Come on, how could you not do that? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Friday. The Dow Industrials advanced 46 points, about a 3%, 15,010. The number of the NASDAQ picked up 19 points, about a 0.5%. 3657, the S&P 500 gained 7, 0.4%, 1646. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.